This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The legislature convened on Tuesday to take care of a number of important bills that will need to be settled in the next few months. So lawmakers typically get down to business pretty quickly. But this year, the Senate first had to make a decision it's never been asked to make before. It had to decide whether or not to suspend one of its own members. Senator Norm McAllister, who was arrested last May at the State House just before the session wrapped up. He was charged with 3 counts of felony sexual assault and 3 misdemeanor charges of prohibited acts. McAllister has consistently proclaimed his innocence and says he shouldn't be forced to resign over something he didn't do. But some of his colleagues were very uncomfortable with the nature of his charges and the time away from his government work that a likely trial in February will cause. They said that if he wasn't going to resign, he should be expelled. Suspension rather than expulsion proved an easier task, and yesterday the Senate met to see if they could agree. In the end, 20 senators voted for suspension, 10 voted against it. So Norm McAllister has been stripped of all of his duties and suspended with pay until his trial is concluded. We're going to talk about what went down yesterday in the Senate, what the major arguments both for and against suspension were, and how the Senate thought about this precedent-setting decision. We're joined in the studio today by Senator Philip Baruth, who spoke in favor of suspending McAllister, and Senator Peg Flory, who spoke against the resolution. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
Thanks, Jane.
Thank you.
We invited Senator McAllister to join us today, and he declined, but he did speak in his own defense during yesterday's debate, and we're going to hear a little bit of that. He began by apologizing to the Senate for the tumultuous circumstances, his words, but maintained his innocence.
It would have been much easier, as the senator from Chittenden pointed out, had I resigned way back in the beginning, but I felt that I was not guilty of anything. And the only person in this room that actually knows that I'm not guilty of anything is me. Others may be judging me or prejudging me by what was written, what they saw. That's not always fact, and you all know that. I have a daughter and 4 granddaughters. I am very much in line with any kind of sexual harassment. I have always voted to support any bill that was against domestic abuse. I have not done anything to warrant this.
McAllister continued that he's very aware of the seriousness of the charges.
I've got people who want to put me in prison for the rest of my life. I'm very much aware of what is at stake. The easy route would have been to just try to avoid all this and not have to face anybody. I've chosen not to take the easy route, mostly because I know that I didn't do anything. And by you doing what these proceedings are taking away the people who supported me and who voted me into office. And I don't think that that is the right message to be sending to anybody either.
Norm McAllister there in slightly muffled audio speaking yesterday afternoon in the debate on the Senate floor saying, I don't think that this would be the right message to be sending to anybody. But in the end, that is the message that was sent. Senator Norm McAllister was suspended from the Senate. Senator Baruth, you presented the resolution to suspend McAllister. You were part of the Rules Committee that had earlier voted on a recommendation to the full Senate to suspend Senator McAllister. Can you tell us what the resolution said?
Sure. It was a one-sentence resolution, and it was based, I should say, on a precedent from last year in California, or rather, at this point, 2 years ago, 2014. And what it said was that Senator Norman H. McAllister would be suspended from the powers of his office until the charges, the criminal charges proceeding against him, were dismissed. And it was limited to that on purpose, both in California and here, to clarify the discussion and to allow us just to consider the precedent-setting action of suspension.
And why suspension instead of expulsion, which you had initially favored?
Right. Expulsion would have solved a couple of problems in that it would have allowed the voters of Franklin County to have continuous representation. And that was a very big concern for everyone. it would have also settled the pay question, because upon being expelled, the Constitution would indicate that Senator McAllister would no longer receive any compensation. However, I think it's fair to say that the votes were not there in our body. The will was not there. And I was substantially convinced by people like Senator Flory and people like Senate President John Campbell, President Pro Tem John Campbell, that it could negatively impact the ongoing court case. And so I went back to the drawing board to figure out, was there a way that we could protect both the court case and the chamber and the people in it? And it seemed to me suspension was the way to do that.
Senator Flory, one of the things that had come up in this debate was the idea in the United States of somebody being innocent until proven guilty. And many of the senators who voted in favor of suspension said that doesn't apply in this body. We're not trying to render judgment in this case. You have vocally supported Norm McAllister since his arrest in May and often have cited that presumption of somebody is innocent until proven guilty. Why do you think that presumption applies in this case about whether or not he should be seated in the Senate, not on rendering judgment in his trial?
Well, I have to back up a little. I have supported or opposed the concept of expelling or suspending, not regardless of who the person we're talking about was. In this instance, it was Senator McAllister. There is not a whole lot of difference, I don't believe, frankly, between expulsion and suspension, other than the expulsion, as Senator Baruth said, would replace Norm's seat and would not allow him to receive pay. The difficulty for me, expulsion is in the Constitution. Suspension is not. Suspension is in Mason's rules. And it, in rules, when we had our meeting on it, it became clear that although California had done it, to me, the California case was very, very different, because the California senators had not opposed, they had not taken a position. The three accused were not fighting it. That's number one. Number two.
I think these were three senators who were accused on gun charges of
corruption,
some sort.
And gun trafficking.
Okay. Correct.
And so they were not trying to fight their expulsion or their
Correct.
Suspension from
Correct.
The California Senate.
Correct.
And Norm McAllister, of course, has been fighting. As we heard, he spoke on his own behalf. He has not resigned, though there have been many calls to resign.
Correct. And on that same issue, as the senator just said, we did not do the expulsion because not only wasn't there the political will, but under the protections in the Constitution, there's a variety of steps you have to jump through, including taking testimony, et cetera, which could have jeopardized the prosecution's ability to successfully prosecute or Norm's ability to successfully defend. The difficulty with a suspension is, I believe, you still have some due process issues that weren't followed. The resolution that we passed gave no grounds for suspending, which I think is a dangerous precedent to set in Vermont. I really wonder what's going to happen when a legislator gets cited for a DUI or some other incident.
It sounds like almost what you're arguing here is procedural and legal and not what I've heard from you several times, which is, I think yesterday you said every grain of my being says we should not be doing this. We should be upholding the idea of innocent until proven guilty.
Absolutely. I think we should.
So is it both for you? Is it both procedural and this concept?
It is both. I understand the difference that this is a Senate body that has its rule for its behavior in the Senate. There's no allegation that I'm aware of that anything occurred in the Senate body that would make us take action. So what essentially we did was we took action yesterday to suspend based on the charges, and then there is a presumption of innocence and I feel strongly about that. In the California case, I'll also point out their constitution is entirely different than ours. They don't have in their constitution the guaranteed right of representation that the Franklin County people have to their two senators. They also don't have in the legislators' oath of office, which is in our constitution, that we swear to not do anything to abridge the rights of our constituents, which includes both Senator McAllister and the citizens of Franklin County. So I think it was just really set up a poor precedent.
We've been hearing from listeners before the show who are sharing their thoughts on this. Morning Fox says, he may be a bad guy, but I thought this country had an ideal of innocent until proven guilty. This seems a bit backwards. David says, innocent until proven guilty has nothing to do with it. That's for the criminal system. The question here is whether Senator McAllister can effectively function in the Senate and whether he has impugned his office merely by being charged with such crimes. Heather says this keeps his constituents without representation, bad precedent. Anyone could make accusations. Apparently, you don't get your day in court in Vermont. And David replies, anyone can make accusations, but this has gone well beyond mere accusations. Criminal charges are much more than accusations. If you'd like to weigh in with your thoughts, your questions for Senators Flory and Baruth, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your comments, robust discussion on our Facebook page going on about this issue of the suspension of Norm McAllister, voted on yesterday by the Senate. Senator Baruth, I know you wanted to weigh in.
Sure. There were just a couple of things I'd like to say in response to what Senator Flory said. One was the due process requirement. She is correct that under expulsion, we were told that we would need a relatively elaborate process with witnesses, et cetera. We were also advised that under suspension, there was a limited due process requirement because it was a limited suspension rather than a permanent one. And so what was given to Senator McAllister was notice of the charges. He was allowed to attend and speak at the Rules Committee hearing, where we voted on the resolution originally. He was allowed to attend, speak, and vote yesterday, and he was provided legal counsel by our legislative counsel arm throughout the process.
Why was he allowed to vote? Aren't there rules in the Senate against conflicts of interest that might have prevented him from voting on his own?
I think generally conflict of interest has been interpreted to be that you would benefit financially from something you're voting on. In this case, I think it was a gray area. My reading was that Senator McAllister did, under our rules, have the right to vote. And I spoke to that in my presentation. And I said I thought it was fair that he be allowed to do so. However, it was an indication of the sort of power that a senator wields in the building. And my main argument was that having been accused of abusing that power, and Senator Flory said that she didn't think there was any allegation that Senator McAllister had done anything to break our rules in the chamber. He did have a woman that he presented as his statehouse intern, and that was something that the case turned on, is that she has criminally alleged that he sexually assaulted her. I think that was a deciding factor for many people, and that was the reason why we have never taken an action like this in Vermont history. And I think that that aspect was one of the reasons why, in this case, we found the will to do so.
Senator Flory.
And I'll just respond. He's absolutely correct. That was one of the allegations by one of the accusers. But I'll go back to the innocent till proven guilty. It hasn't been found in a court of law that he ever did abuse that intern.
But in many jobs, somebody will be removed with pay or without pay, depending on, you know, what kind of job it is, or even fired in many private sector jobs if somebody's been indicted on charges that are this serious. And that's not, you know, whether there's a presumption of guilt or innocence. That's, you know, you can't keep this job, or you can't be actively working in this position in a hospital or a school or somewhere else with these charges pending against you.
You're absolutely right. Police, it happens to teachers, happens to many. And there are statutory protections there and contract protections. Under the statute, any of those people have due process rights before they're suspended. There is due process. They can be suspended for no more than maximum is a 20-day period without having a hearing and a right to due process. So that's a little bit different. However, I'll also point out that there is no mechanism for an elected official to be fired. If you have a town treasurer that is elected, that is charged with embezzlement, that person is in there. You cannot suspend that person.
You have to vote them out.
You have to vote them out. And a senator is an elected official.
Let me let a few other listeners weigh in here, because as I said, this is something that a lot of Vermonters have been following and thinking about, because, you know, I think it's a somewhat salacious case, but also because it does affect our government and our elected leaders. Dave says the action against Senator McAllister sets a bad precedent. The most recent case I can recall like this was that of Michael Grimm, a congressman from New York. He was under investigation for 20 counts of fraud, federal tax evasion, and perjury, but was not suspended while under investigation. Think what could happen in the future. With dirty political tricks, people could falsify rape charges against a politician to keep him from casting an important vote in the Senate. Andy writes in to say the suspension is completely appropriate and says a Vermont state senator is tasked with acting to keep Vermonters safe and doing the work of the public. This important work requires complete attention. In addition, this important work can't be done when there's a risk of a hidden agenda of avoiding prosecution. It does not matter what Senator McAllister says he can do. It doesn't matter that he claims he can still do his job. The Senate acted correctly in suspending him. They acted to eliminate the risk he poses to the serious business of the Senate while he's under investigation. Other comments. Mark writes, would this suspension versus expulsion talk even be an issue if McAllister was able to get a speedy trial in the first place? Here we are over 7 months after the arrest and charges and still no trial. If the criminal legal process went forth as something faster than a snail's pace, perhaps it would be a nothing burger right now. And Tony says, I think one has to compare this to what would and has taken place for teachers, police officers, physicians, etc. Suspension from their positions of authority is done routinely with these sorts of charges. This is especially important here, where one of the charges pertains to misconduct with a legislative aide. And on that note, we got a letter from Catherine, who wants to ask about the procedures regarding interns. One of the charges against Norm McAllister is that he had inappropriate sexual contact with somebody who he called his intern. And Catherine says, I've heard nothing about how or if legislative interns are protected from predatory legislators, are they? Does anyone even keep a register of the names and addresses of interns and who supervises them? Is there a policy on what constitutes an internship, or is this a label that any legislator can apply as loosely as he or she wants to? If there's no policy currently regarding interns, has anyone proposed one? And is anyone looking a little more closely at the legislative page program, or is that considered to be adequately supervised? And now I do want to point out, this intern was not a legislative page. That's a completely separate program. But Catherine's questions still apply.
Right. Catherine is completely on point. When these charges came down and as they began to spool out in the media, I took notice particularly because I was appointed at the end of last session the chair of the Senate Sexual Harassment Panel. And so it seemed to me that there was a gap in terms of how we treated interns in the building. And so I sat down with the new sergeant-at-arms, and she is doing a fantastic job. She and I worked out a procedure to create a registry, which is now up and running. And the idea is that anyone who comes into the building and works in my name is required to either download the form to register or to go in person to the office. Whether they download or fill it out and bring it in, they must have a face-to-face conversation with the sergeant-at-arms. At that point, she advises them of many things, rules about etiquette in the statehouse, but also, very importantly, the rules on sexual harassment, where to go in terms of more information, how to lodge a complaint. And so the only thing remaining to be done there is that the Rules Committee later this session will consider a rule that will define what an intern is and will also make it clear that it is an individual senator's responsibility that his or her intern register.
We're talking today about the state Senate's decision yesterday to suspend colleague Norm McAllister. We're hearing from two senators on opposite sides of the decision about how they think the rules should apply in a case like this. And we're also taking your questions and your perspective. If you'd like to add it to the mix, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. When we come back, one of the questions that we want to dive into a little bit is, how now does the Senate do its important work of passing bills and debating big issues in the state when it's had such a divisive vote? You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're discussing why the Vermont Senate decided yesterday to suspend colleague Norm McAllister while he's under indictment for sex crimes. We're talking with Senator Philip Ruth, who spoke in favor of suspending McAllister, and Senator Peg Flory, who spoke against the resolution. And we're hearing thoughts from our listeners as well. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Eric, calling in from Greensboro. Hi, Eric. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to point out to everybody that it was Senator McAllister himself who last October admitted to 7 Days newspaper that he did have a sexual relationship with a 16-year-old girl whom he called his intern. And on the basis of his own words, this was a very simple, clear-cut issue in my mind that he should have been suspended. He's definitely impugned his office, and I think he's done so permanently. I think now we definitely need to have a Senate Ethics Committee in place and to make it clear that the senators should be subject to high standards of ethics and personal behavior. That is the case in private industry. In the rest of our society these days, it should definitely be the case among our elected officials.
Eric, thanks for your perspective. Thanks for sharing it. Let's go to John in Waterbury, and then Senator Flory, I'll come back to you. John, go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I'd just like to make the point that as elected officials, they should be held to a higher standard, not a lower standard. It seems that, you know, the theme of, you know, innocent till proven guilty keeps coming up. But again, even to have charges alleged against him, there has to be a significant amount of evidence for the police to do that. So even from that standpoint, I think it was totally appropriate. And I commend Senator Baruth and the other senators for his suspension.
John, thanks for your thoughts. Senator Flory, you wanted to object, I think, to something that Eric said.
Well, not so. I wanted to actually agree and object. It was reported that Senator McAllister said he had sex with the intern. Senator McAllister has indicated yesterday that no, that wasn't what he thought he was responding to. So I don't think there was ever an admission, which may be part of the reason this is being delayed, since the state has now tried to subpoena 7 Days and all of those folks. But I also wanted to agree with both of the speakers that, yes, as legislators, we should set ourselves to a higher standard. And I would hope we would take this really difficult issue for all of us, that we would take this as a wake-up call to start setting up some parameters. If we had parameters in effect that gave clear ground rules that, and the results that if this happens, if you do this, this is the action the Senate will take, I would be a whole lot more comfortable. And we did have one option in the sexual harassment policy that anybody, even not the victim, someone that thought something was wrong with this intern, could have brought an action, and there is a process in there. And I hope if we find there's some loopholes in that, that we take this as an opportunity to tighten those loopholes up, because certainly the public has a right to expect proper behavior from us.
to go back to your question, Jane, about how the body moves forward, I began my presentation yesterday by saying that no matter what happened, no one would feel good at the end of the day. And I think that proved very accurate. So when the vote was taken, it was a strong vote. It was 20 to 10, two-thirds of the Senate. It was also a very bipartisan vote. So a majority of Republicans voted for the resolution to suspend, as well as about three-quarters of the Democratic caucus. So with that said, there was a feeling in the chamber of where do we go from here? And one of the things that happened this morning in the House chamber was a joint session, a training on sexual harassment for House and Senate members. Now, it sounds like that could be something that would produce additional feelings of strangeness or revivify the bad feelings from the night before. But I had the opposite effect. The woman who ran it was very smart. She was very competent. She was a witty person. And I thought it produced a kind of good fellow feeling in that chamber going forward. So I would like to say a thank you to Senator Flory, first of all. She is a senator I respect greatly. I've learned a lot from her. Her motives in this case were absolutely what they should be. And so I hope that the way the two of us have responded to one another, the way Senate Minority Leader Joe Benning and I work together, I hope those things can be a model going forward.
Do you agree, Senator Flory?
I do. You know, yesterday was a day none of us ever wanted to see. Wasn't easy for anyone, regardless of what position you're in. Senator Baruth and I, it's not the first time we've disagreed, won't be the last time we've disagreed, and then we'll go have a cup of tea. It's one of the best things about the Vermont legislature. Most of us realize that the person you disagree with strongest the day before can be your best ally the next day. And most of the issues, frankly, that we deal with in the legislature, most issues aren't black or white. They're different shades of gray. And if you don't listen to both sides, you never get the right shade of gray. So do I think his position was incorrect? Sure I do. Will I work with him on another issue? Sure I will.
I have something I want to talk to you about.
Good luck. Maybe we need to wait another day or two before we were all perfectly calm. But I can tell you, I had some senators that voted opposite, and they came up to me today and said, thank you for bringing up that side. You almost changed my mind.
We're talking today about the suspension of Senator Norm McAllister, and we're speaking with Senators Baruth and Flory, who, as we've just heard, were on opposite sides of that debate. And it was a debate that was spirited is probably not the right word, but this is a very serious issue. Somber, Peg Flory is saying to me, is a more appropriate word. And it was one that was not on party lines, but a 20 to 10 vote in favor of suspension. We have more listeners with questions and thoughts. Pete's on the line from Burlington. Hi, Pete. Go right ahead.
Philip, I have all the respect in the world for you for your candor and tact on your statement on this issue. I'd like to hear some discussion about the fact that McAllister is getting his full salary while not even being at work. I don't know of anybody that does not go to work and gets paid. So, you know, clearly we've got a problem. He maintains his innocence. Three women have come forward and said that they've been sexually abused by him. So there's definitely a problem. Thank you.
Thanks for your call and to your question about pay, getting paid, and this idea of suspension rather than expulsion. And suspension does keep with it the pay. Philip Baruth, this was something that you mentioned at the beginning was part of your deliberations on whether or not you could do something that you thought would stand up legally.
Exactly. So the California precedent was the same way in that they realized that pay would continue even if they suspended. They didn't want to pay the people who were under suspension, so they put forward a constitutional amendment to try to change that. I think it was largely symbolic, because by the time it could ever change their constitution, these people would have long ago either been voted out or brought back in. So in my thinking about it, no matter what we did, if Norman McAllister refused to resign, he was going to get paid. The Constitution would insist that he be paid if he were suspended, and had we voted down the resolution, he would have continued to be paid. So I thought less about pay. The only question that I did have in my mind was, should he be paid expenses? And we found out from the Senate Secretary that no, he would not be paid his expenses. So, you know, that's not...
These are things like reimbursement for housing or food or travel.
Yes, and mileage, that sort of thing. So that is substantial over the course of a session. That pay will stop, but constitutionally there was nothing we could do about pay. Do we want to change the Constitution? Very long, arduous process in Vermont, but I take the listener's point. It's something we might think about, along with other people have talked about a recall provision. I certainly think that's worth thinking about, too.
We don't have a recall provision, though. And one of the issues that has come up is, without Senator McAllister sitting in the body, without him able to vote, but while still holding his seat during this suspension, there is less of a voice or less of a representation for Franklin County constituents. Dustin DeGree, his Franklin County colleague, did vote in favor of the suspension. But Senator Flory, do you think McAllister should now resign so that somebody else can be put in his seat so that there is full representation for his constituents?
Part of my reason for arguing the position I had in the substitute resolution that I put in that also was defeated by the same majority called for him to be – the substitute called for him to continue in office until a verdict. And part of that was my concern that Franklin County was not being represented if we suspended him. Would I hope that he would consider resigning at this point? Yes, I would, because of Franklin County not being represented, which I think is a totally different issue than should he have resigned before all of this.
Or should he have been suspended?
Yes.
The resolution, as you mentioned right at the beginning, Senator Baruth, says, resolved that the Senate hereby suspends Senator Norman H. McAllister from exercising any of the powers of his office as a member of the Senate until all criminal proceedings currently pending against him have been dismissed.
Right.
So does that mean he has to be acquitted of all charges? He has three felony sexual assault counts against him, as well as three misdemeanor prohibited acts. So do all six charges need to be dismissed, or is there some way he could be reinstated if, for example, he was acquitted of the more serious charges but found guilty of the misdemeanors?
The way the Senate Secretary explained it to me is that there were two ways where Senator McAllister could automatically come back. If the state were unilaterally to drop all the charges, he would automatically come back. If he's found innocent on all the charges, he would automatically come back. So there would no action needed by the Senate, no action needed by voters. On the other hand, if he pleads guilty to one of the misdemeanor charges, if he pleads guilty to two of the misdemeanor charges, those are more complicated questions. He would not come back automatically, but it would be in the Senate's discretion. Could they act to bring him back at that point? I think personally I would oppose that, but I think theoretically it is a possibility that we could take up the issue after his case has resolved if it doesn't produce all innocent verdicts.
Let me ask one other question, Senator Flory. One of the things that particularly for senators voting in favor of suspension, one of the things that they've said and one of the things that we've discussed is it's not about whether he's guilty or innocent. Do you believe that to be true? Do you think that this vote, that people, if they in their heart of hearts thought there is no way that this man is guilty of these charges, that they would have voted for suspension? Or does that somehow always color the perspective, whether or not you think he's guilty?
I think it was a very uncomfortable position for a lot of people to be in, not knowing if he was innocent or guilty. having to face people every day, face Norm McAllister every day, face the press asking questions about it, that it was easier to suspend him. It was more convenient. It arguably made our jobs easier to not have to be reminded every day. And I think that very process of making it easier did away with the presumption of innocence. I think people just don't step back and think about it. And I really wonder what's going to happen the next time somebody gets charged with, a legislator gets charged with a DUI, gets charged with a domestic assault, gets charged with something. This resolution, we suspended for no stated reason. That, I think, sets a really dangerous precedent.
Well, we'll have to follow up and see what happens next, and if there's more discussion around what kind of rules there should be in the Senate for a procedure like this. Senator Peg Flory, Senator Philip Ruth, thank you very much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
Coming up, Bruce Bovat, Burlington Deputy Police Chief, joins us to talk about how the department is preparing for the huge crowds expected at the Donald Trump event tonight. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We broadcast live in the noon hour, but tonight at 7, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump will make a campaign speech at the Flynn Center for the Performing Arts in downtown Burlington. The event was just announced on New Year's Eve, and it was met with excitement by some and outrage by others. The Trump campaign has notified the Burlington Police Department that it has given out nearly 20,000 free tickets. But the Flynn only has a capacity of 1,400, and managing the first-come, first-seated crowd could be problematic. Add to that, detractors of the controversial candidate have been encouraging protests against Donald Trump. Some of those protests are focused on City Hall Park, right across the street from the Flynn. Burlington's police department is working to manage the expected influx of supporters and critics into the downtown area this evening. Bruce Bovat, Burlington Deputy Police Chief, joins us to explain those plans. Deputy Chief, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you.
The Trump campaign has informed you that of those nearly 20,000 people who had requested tickets or had gotten those nearly 20,000 tickets, because I think you could get two each, the campaign could verify 6,500 people by valid emails. So how many people are you actually expecting downtown tonight who are going to try to get in to see the candidate speak?
Yeah, well, as they explained, you know, there's no exact science to how they get those hard numbers. They were just explaining, trying to get a rough guesstimate, but that is the number they provided with us. We don't have an exact number, so we're going to go with 6,500 right now. And so that would give you approximately 4,000-plus people who will not be able to get into the Flynn. So there's 4,000. We're also looking at social media, blogging, trying to estimate how many people might show up in opposition of Mr. Trump. And that varies anywhere from 300 to 1,000. So our number is very fluid.
Well, yeah, and I think if I'm doing your math, I think if there are 6,500 people you assume are actually going to try to show up there and 1,400 seats, it's 5,000 people who may not be able to get in.
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So you think there could be, 5,000, 6,000, somewhere around that, people milling around right downtown, either trying to get into the venue or protesting the event. How does that actually compare to other crowds on big nights in Burlington?
Well, I've been asked that question so many times, and this is kind of unique. When we have large crowds, and people have compared it to the marathon or July 3rd festivities, we have, 30,000, 40,000 people on those, but they're spread out over a greater venue. So if you do have 5,000 to 6,000 people in that congested area of City Hall Park or Main Street or directly in front of the Flynn, that's going to be a very dense population.
This could be, yeah, it makes perfect sense. And this could be, given that the people are all crowded into that one area and there are people with very different motivations, this could be a quite volatile situation. How do you prepare for that?
Well, we are hoping... Well, that's our job, is public safety. As I've explained to other people, no matter what the event is, we always look at what are the possible hazards or potential downfalls, and then we plan for that and come up with a contingency as best we can for any foreseeable issues. You touched upon our greatest concern, and that is politics is a very heated topic. Mr. Trump is definitely a unique individual who has some strong supporters and some strong opponents. So if we do have 1, 2, 3, 5,000 people of his following outside, we want to be able to keep them in a safe location and keep the people who are there to oppose them in a safe location so everybody can express their First Amendment right without enticing each other. And that's where we come into, is hopefully we will be able to mitigate any problems before they arise to a large level. But, I mean, Burlingtonians as a whole are very peaceful and show up in protests in a very dignified manner for the most part. So we're confident that it's going to go off without any significant issues.
When you say, though, that you think about the volatility and the possibilities and then you prepare for that, what does that mean? Does that just mean a greater police presence than normal or something else specific?
Yep, we have officers positioned in what we consider would be very key or strategic locations throughout the venue and the surrounding venue. We have called for support from our friends in the local law enforcement and primarily the Vermont State Police, who will be up and able to assist us. So there will be a very strong police presence, both uniform and plainclothes, non-uniform, in and out of the Flynn. If we were to see something, we will go in and, at the least intrusive manner, try to quash it before it grows out of control. We're hoping that we can address any issues at the lowest level.
There are also federal agents, right? There's Secret Service who travel with candidate Trump?
Yeah, so the Secret Service will have a pretty significant contingent, but their primary mission and goal is just the protection of the protectee. They have made that clear that that's their job, and our job is to assist them inside, but our main focus will be the exterior of the Flynn and the surrounding venue.
You know, some people have been asking why you haven't canceled the event, why the Burlington Police Department hasn't canceled or sanctioned the campaign in some way, given that nearly 20,000 tickets were handed out for a venue that has a capacity of 1,400. And this has come up especially after Chief Del Pozo was quoted in the press as saying that if it were promoters for a Phish concert that oversold by that degree, the concert would definitely be canceled.
Yes, he did say that. And I think one of the things he wants to be aware of is this is not a Phish concert. And, you know, a concert is a concert, but he was weighing out carefully the impact on the immediate surrounding society. But this is an individual, it's a presidential candidate, and we're trying to make sure we can provide a venue where somebody can come and espouse their beliefs and get to their people and pass on their ideologies and get the votes and make contact with the citizens. And that's why we do not want to be the one to come and quash that. So what we're trying to do rather than is mitigate any potential problems and afford him the opportunity to speak to the citizens of Burlington and Vermont.
Well, let me afford you the same opportunity. Is there a message that you're trying to get out to people who are planning to be
goodness.
In Burlington today?
Our message would be please come, please participate in this historic event, exercise your right to free speech, but just do it peacefully and do it with great care for your fellow man.
And Deputy Chief Bovat, before we let you go, practically speaking, for residents of the state's largest city or anyone who plans to travel in downtown Burlington tonight, what traffic and parking restrictions should they be aware of?
Yep, so Main Street will be shut down completely to all motor vehicle except for a few key buses that need to get through from Church Street to St. Paul Street, and Lower Church will be shut down from Main Street to King Street. So they need to know that they won't be able to bypass through there. And in addition to that, we'll have a good segment of the St. Paul Street metered for media parking.
And in fact, we're almost at 1 p.m. here as we broadcast live, and I think some of those restrictions go into place at 1, right? So people, even this afternoon, should not anticipate that they're going to be able to travel freely or park freely in downtown Burlington.
That is correct. Again, we're trying to make this the least intrusive on anybody, so if a car's there, we're going to try our best to find the owner. But if we have to, we do have a timeline, they will be towed away, but We're hoping nobody gets towed.
All right. Well, I hope for your sake that's the case. Bruce Bovat is the Burlington Deputy Police Chief. Again, the city is preparing for presidential candidate Donald Trump to speak this evening downtown. Deputy Chief Bovat, thank you very much for your time today.
You're so welcome. Have a great day.
And that will do it for today's program. Tomorrow, we're going to talk to a lineup of top political reporters about this very full week of Vermont news. You can send your questions or just send us your thoughts. Send us your reflections on what you've been seeing in Vermont politics this week, Vermont news, from the legislative kickoff and the Governor Shumlin's State of the State address to Senator McAllister's suspension and, of course, Donald Trump in Burlington. We are, as always, at vermontedition@vpr.net. So send us a note and then join us live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gail Rosen. Mary Williams directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.